He's okay.
He might.
No, he's okay. But you can if you want to.
Yeah.
Well, here we are. We're in Tacoma, Washington. It's Friday, July 25th, 1997. I'm here with Anne. How do you spell your last name, Anne?
H-E-N-S-L-E-Y.
Okay. Honestly. Occasionally I'll ask you to spell things because there'll be someone transcribing, especially if you can think of spelling the Vietnamese towns. Mm-hmm. Like Hue, I think the students know H-U-E, but other than that, they might need a little help. Okay. And we always start out with a couple of just real simple questions. Your birth date?
December 21, 1937.
And you were born in?
Lexington, Kentucky.
And when you were born, what were your parents doing? What were their occupations?
My father was a chemistry professor at Georgetown College.
Mm-hmm. Have any schooling? Other
people?
Yeah.
Yeah. She was an RN.
Uh-huh.
And what now would be, she did radiology. She
kept doing that after the kids grew up?
No.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have an older sister and a younger brother.
And did you ever have any inkling when you were growing up that you would go overseas or have any international interests?
Oh, yeah.
What was the source of that?
I don't know.
You just had it.
Well, I always wanted to get as far away from wherever I was as I could.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, but so many IVSers say that same thing. But they usually had more reason. In the sense that they were from very small, a lot of them were from very small towns in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like anything other than this would be fine.
Yeah.
Did you go to college?
Oh, yeah. Finally ended up getting my BA at the University of Missouri.
In the field?
Well, it was actually education, but it in math and, math and geography and I don't know what all.
Mm-hmm. And you got a teaching credential, though, out of that? So what was your degree actually in? I mean, the name. Is it like B.A. in education or something like that?
Yes, in math education, I think is what it was.
And did you go directly into teaching, or was that when you were teaching?
I taught junior high math in Denver, Colorado for a couple of years before. I knew that I needed to get some classroom experience before I did
anything. Did anything? Were you thinking already of doing something else?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What was that? What were your plans?
I wanted to go to India, which is a little ironic there. So I started your first year of teaching, as you know, is pretty horrendous, pretty demanding. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't thinking about much of anything until probably towards the end of my first year, and then I started researching how to get over that.
Jim Kelly.
Oh, yeah.
How did you meet Jim Kelly?
Well, he was going to school at Colorado State University, and I was taking Hindi in summer school.
At Colorado State?
At Colorado. Well, they were really very internationally minded at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I assume they still are.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet him? Was he speaking on campus?
Well, no, he was in school there, and we had mutual friends.
Ah.
And I was very impressed with him, my family's farmers.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty decent. I liked his little key. And I liked what he said about living with the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
because I didn't want to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. He said, why don't you consider going?
He said, why don't you go to Vietnam? And I said, what?
Let's see, what year would that have been?
That was, I met him in 62, summer of 62, mm-hmm. and then.
You sent in a letter of application. Did you ever meet anyone from IVS?
I don't think so. Now, I don't think so. I think just Jim.
Mm-hmm. And, they sent you a plane ticket. You went to San Francisco.
No, we went to our group went to Washington. They were
for a briefing.
Yeah, we at that time they were given maybe even 10 days.
Because they didn't have Harper's Ferry going yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
No.
Then when in the 10 days of briefing, did you get a State Department briefing on?
Yeah.
Yet?
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
I don't remember.
Most people don't remember. By the way, I just interviewed someone who did.
Oh,
really?
And could verbatim recount it, and it was very funny. It was apparently a standard Cold War, you know, anti-communism speech. That was supplemented in those days with, you know, went to Harper's Ferry, and there was a chance to... did you get any socialization with the folk you were going over with?
Oh, very much. We were very, by the time we left, we were very close.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anyone from your group?
Oh, vividly. Because then we went to Metaw for our language training.
Right.
And just, you know, if I tried to, I could think of...
That's okay. They'll come up when we talk about Metaw. You flew from Washington to via Hong Kong,
Tokyo and Hong first, Kong. And then Hong Kong, and then so on.
What was your first impression when you arrived at the airport?
In Tansin Yat?
Yeah, Tansin Yat.
I really don't remember, except I think it felt very fresh and green and very nice, I was impressed.
Because you were there in the
63,
winter.
No,
it was
summer.
Winter. You got there by the summer.
Yeah, we were there.
So you applied in the fall of
62. I applied
62.
In the fall, did my second year of teaching. I'm sorry.
That's right. No, that's okay. We filled it in nicely. And then you went to Washington in around June or so?
June. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
that's
it was like
63.
June. Yeah.
And then you went off to Vietnam. So the heat didn't make the biggest impression on you. You were...
You know,
it didn't bother you
if
then.
You've been, I grew up in the Midwest, and Midwest summers, I mean, don't have anything on Vietnam.
Others differ on that, but it's good to get a variety. Well, see that there was a variety of opinions. Were you met at the airport by?
Yes, they took us to the IVS house, mm-hmm. and they fed us. It was supposed to be a big treat, but it was raw. It was supposed to be hamburger grilled. And it was terrible, and it was half raw, and it just, you know, it was not so great. And they kind of said hi, and we were there for maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours. And then they put us in vans and took us down to Metaw.
After a few days, though.
No.
Right after the meal?
Straight away.
Oh, my goodness. And so you went right to Metaw, and...
Right to Metaw, and then... in the drive down, I was instantly enthralled by the rice patties in that drive, because it's just...
It's still a great drive.
I was in the group in 87 that went back.
But we'll get to that. But...
how long are you...
you were enthralled by what you saw, this is what you'd come for, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you arrived at Metaw. Did they have? Were you the first woman in Metaw? Was had there?
Yeah, Carly and I were the first. Uh-huh. First.
Carly knew me.
Yeah, Carly.
N-U-M-I.
Yeah.
Right. And did they have accommodations for you?
The men stayed, and we had our classes in one house, mm-hmm. and then Carly and I, Ray Johnson and Marge.
In the house?
Yeah, we had an apartment, mm-hmm. actually, when the storefront things, mm-hmm. and we were just a few blocks away, but they took us there and said, we'll come back and get you for dinner, mm-hmm. and I had no idea where we were, and I was just, they said they'd come back after dinner, and our cook didn't speak any, Carly was fluent in French, mm-hmm. is fluent. It was a roast chicken with the feet and the head still on, and the head was
anyway.
Yeah.
And they came and picked you up.
And they
then.
Came and picked us
up. So, how long were you in Metaw for language instruction?
I think that was 6 weeks.
How useful was it?
Well, for me, it wasn't, except that it just convinced me profoundly that I would. A lot of people. Found it very useful.
Well, rule of thumb was it would take about a year to learn Vietnamese. Did you improve over time?
Like that. Oh, yeah. Oh, by the... I did 2 tours. I've had friends who didn't speak English. I had a lot of friends who didn't speak English. I could do just the thing I really wanted to do.
And where were you, what was your assignment? Were you going to be an educationist?
I was in Meetah. Carly and I ended up in Meetah, and we were very discouraged because, you know, John Summer was going off to Vermont. Pete Hunting was going off somewhere exotic, and I think Willie Myers went to New Chung, but they were, and Carl Stockton was going down to further down into the, they were going off to all these exciting places, and here we were in
You were assigned to what? You were assigned to a middle school or a high school?
I taught at the boys' high school. Mm-hmm. Carly taught at the girls' high school.
And how did you find the, did you ever have a, was there an agenda in the sense that you would help them, for example, with fluency?
Pronunciation. And we both taught the early years of high school would be the, not a lot, but we just had them for just a, well, I got my, for me, I had a couple hours a week, mm-hmm. and I,
Make friends with the faculty of the school?
Yeah.
Have you been able to keep in touch with any of them?
Not really. I did. I lived with my co-teacher in L.A. I came back.
We've been able to make contact with Vietnamese. Some of that is just because of the war. Reflections on that as we go along.
It's very complex, and I'm one who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Okay. I think a lot of it is because I'm gay.
Mm-hmm. The teacher you used to work with in Vietnam, you ended up living with in Los Angeles?
I wasn't out.
I see. Well, there were a lot of gay IVSers.
Oh, I know that now.
Yes. Well, some of them didn't know they were gay, though, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, I did.
Tom Amiano was one of the real delights of this particular effort. Well, that person was so deep in the league, he had no idea. You know, I like that. And did you have a sense? Now that's a silly question to ask, and unfortunately, our culture hasn't evolved to a point where we know how to address these things in English.
Yeah.
But when you went to Vietnam, were you aware of sexuality?
Very much.
Yeah.
And I actually had two relationships
when you were there. The reason I ask is because it's interesting, but I don't ask any of the people who we interview whether they were straight. Which is interesting, you know, this comes up. How many sexual experiences did you have when you were in Vietnam? Those don't come up, and it's a... I don't know whether it is even an issue worth exploring. And maybe when we're done, we'll see.
No, I think it's critical.
Yeah.
I mean, because it, like for me, not even having anything at all to do with sex, mm-hmm. but the women deal with. I mean, I might be riding on a little stool along with all the other, you know, the two sisters and I was in the relationship with him, you know, that is, you don't get that unless you're just really tied in.
That's CIA. And friend of Americans were CIA. Mark and I, he just went back to eating his soup. We'll set her on the table laughing, you know, kind of mirthfully, quietly. And there's an intimacy there that it's...
And then they look at you and they say, oh yeah, you're an American, aren't you?
Yeah, something
you know,
like that.
They don't say but it's just so obvious that you have
fortunately, you actually have your own caste hierarchy for you, which you have an outcast status of a special sort, and so. But any family that would have me in for dinner is well beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get too ahead of ourselves here. But when you were in Meetah, you settled into the school,
mm-hmm.
and you were. Did you teach a siesta separated session, mm-hmm. 9 to 12, 2 to
8 to 10, and
8
then
to 10.
2 to 4.
2 to 4. And Meetah was kind of a IVS center
for
a variety of things.
Yeah,
so
it was
so you would
first.
See a lot of other IVSers.
We did, and we would also see, like Paul Worthington, mm-hmm. came and actually lived in our garage. My pa was one of the first IBSers. I don't know if you... He died. Mm-hmm. Linda Weir went to us.
Were you there then? Were you still there in 68?
Yeah. I lived in Way. My home was Way during the Tet Offensive.
During the Tet Offensive. We'll get back to that because that's got its own fascinating story. But you were there, let's see, in Meetah. You did your whole first 2 years, your first contract in Meetah.
I did go to Hue for a summer.
Mm-hmm. For a summer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Getting the science mobile. We were going to teach science out in the boonies, all the gear into a van, and then
there over a period of time. It's a lot of nice. That's an interesting time period.
Yes,
because it's basically bridging when the war is very distant, and then it becomes very intense. And what were your do you remember what your perspectives were about the political situation in Vietnam as time passed? Did it change?
Oh yeah.
See, innocent questions that you ask. Yes.
Well, when I really didn't know a whole lot what was going on, and I definitely didn't. Now in my reading, I find out that Meetah was the home of some of the most powerful anti-government movements, even back in World War II. And I had not a clue of things like that. I knew that the Vietnamese government was not, and I thought we had the solutions for them. I don't remember in a whole lot of detail what my thinking was.
Mm-hmm. What was your attitude about what you were trying to do? You've already mentioned that really the reason you went on this expedition, so to speak, was because you wanted to learn something.
Yeah.
Did you think that what you had to give in terms of teaching English would be valuable?
Not the teaching English, mm-hmm. but we started an English club for high school kids, mm-hmm. and we felt very
strong. American presence in Vietnam increased. They needed more and more people who were...
Yeah, I was just always really glad that I didn't, dealing with high school kids, mm-hmm. you didn't even think about that aspect. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about that aspect of it. It was just, especially the lower kids, mm-hmm. there was no connection mm-hmm. between the two. Mm-hmm. And then my job in Hue was to start and do an ESL program in the hospital, because mm-hmm. They were going to get, and I didn't worry about them because they were so damn traditional. They were so damn Hue. I wasn't too worried that I was going to distort their points of view. Mm-hmm. That they were going to stay Vietnamese whether they spoke English or not. They were not going to turn into the kind of person that you can see them coming at you a mile away with something they wanted you to do, and they had no interest in you as a person. Mm-hmm.
There's essentially professionals that are already going to be working in a hospital and working with Americans, they would need that language. It's not like you're creating a new entrepreneurial class. You would have found it uncomfortable to find yourself being essentially a trainer of the new bourgeoisie in Vietnam?
I know, yeah. Well, it would depend on the people, but ultimately it got destroyed. Mm-hmm. But in the pretty generous, open hearts and traditional, but willing to entertain new people. So, not everybody, pretty in the difficulty of life in Vietnam would cause them goods, but they are military supplies. They were just coming in with money and just.
Culture was pretty much destroyed. To someone who wouldn't understand that, who wasn't there, how would you describe the impact?
There is, and I'm not, and I say that, and I'm not, it by no means is destroyed, mm-hmm. I don't think, mm-hmm. think, because when I talked to my friend, to Thay, the high school girl, that the other Vietnamese that I meet, and get to, everything that I saw then is here now. But it, there's just an overall gentleness and sweetness. Generosity, I guess, would be probably the key thing. And a faith in the old traditions. And then what happened was that the whole, you just take all these, just everything from the physical part of the country, the land and the forests and the cities, and take the human part of the culture, and you just, it's like taking a salad scoopers from one end of the country to the other and just making this great tossed salad, and what do you end up with? Just a lot of devastation and nothing. Everything was touched by that.
But when you were, in Mitau, did you ever go up on the roof and watch the war from the top of your apartment?
No.
And when did you leave Mitau?
Left June of 65. Mm-hmm. And I'm back, although I was very reluctant to leave, but it just, no strong reason to stay. Well, I ended up back at Colorado State because I really liked Colorado, and he upset me because I was close to him. He was one of my favorites. Painful to watch from the States than it would be to go back, so I ended up going back.
I was going to ask, when your first tour came to an end.
I felt really good about it. Not the teaching part so much, although by that time my kids were terrible and just little jackasses. Glorious times with them. Mm-hmm. Work as much as just the relationships with mine, I'd say. A little past the halfway point, I was really, Mitau.
Mitau?
Yeah.
What was her name again?
Wente Tine.
Okay, so Nguyen.
J-N-H.
And she got her degree in Cornell in what area?
Made the highest score on the entrance exam than anybody ever made. I don't know, but she is the dearest, most loving. She's just
the When's best. The last time you were in touch with her?
Well, I've been in touch with her more now by phone. I haven't seen her anymore. Carly.
Where does she live now?
In Montreal.
In Montreal. Oh, that's right. You mentioned. When you first got there in the summer of 63,
right.
That was actually before Ngo Dinh was assassinated,
right.
And Kennedy was there. What that atmosphere was like then?
The atmosphere? Very calm, very peaceful. There was terror, they'd blow up a coffee shop now and then in Saigon. And of course, out in the countryside, things were going on. But no.
I meant, did anybody talk to you about the assassination of Diem? You were there when all those events happened. Saigon said 60 miles away. Whatever.
We didn't talk about politics.
Yeah. And you didn't talk about politics for a reason. I mean, that was kind of...
I think that we didn't want to offend anybody. And... And I think we were smart enough to know we didn't know enough to. Because I know I have, like Mary Beth Clark, if you talk to her, or you should talk to her. You're kidding!
No.
Mary Beth?
She's probably just like you. She didn't send back her thing.
She's published a textbook on beginning Vietnamese. It's about ready to come out with an intermediate text.
No problem. Love to look her up. But she's never... She didn't send back her form. So you knew enough not to.
It just...
Yeah.
Yeah, because we really wanted to be good visitors. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to put anybody on any kind of... But we do that anyway with some of that. Because we wanted people to read... Well, like we did English club. English teacher teas. And that was so... Vietnamese just don't do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And if we were going to talk about things, we were going to talk about teaching English and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
And when you went back the second time, You had an...
I was supposed to go there in the spring of 66. I never moved there when I was going to talk to the officials and stuff, and it was when... for one thing, he was from Hue, and he knew how to make white people... and he had the respect of white people, and you know...
Why was he removed?
Because he was from Hue, because he knew white
people. What a way to fight a war.
Right. Oh, God, it was just...
And there was an interesting group of people in Hue then. Do you remember the other IPSers?
Steve Earhart, Stephen Hewitt, the ones I remember the most. I was really... because I was in the hospital for a year and then I...
Cell supervisor for I-Corps.
Yeah.
Right, so there was a university there that would fall under your purview, and there were IBSers teaching.
Steve Earhart.
And did you have any contact with the IBSers up in the Vermontan Yards and would come into Hue occasionally?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Probably, but I don't... By that time, I was just a basket case with my...
Rage and dismay directed.
Oh, at the U.S. government. Uh-huh. And it just...
What were we doing?
Well, it depends on your point of view.
Well, what was your point of view? You know, just for the heck of it, everyone else has been frank enough on both sides.
Destroying a country I love better than my own at that point.
Did they have a choice? Was there another course?
I've done enough work on it to understand now that maybe there wasn't. Maybe we did the best we could with what we had, but boy, it was piss poor, let me tell you.
What was an example of the kinds of thing you were angry at? Because, I mean, generally we know what was going on. I mean, there's tremendous pressure on the culture. Nguyen Cao Ky, though, he said, you know, you have war, you have prostitution. You have war, you have corruption. So what's the big deal?
There you're starting with two really good ones. Prostitution was my personal... the Orient, which was just a vast, seeming acknowledgement that there was something wrong with this. Mm-hmm. I don't even really, I fault the Vietnamese for it, but we came in there with just no concept of impacting. The worst thing on that for me was in Hue, for the Tet Offensive, we knew that something was going on. Or we'd go to have Christmas in Dalat. Mm-hmm. And that year in 67, we went to the...
LOC?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not real sure. I mean, the IBSers would drink, mm-hmm. but not like that.
And you had a sense that there's because of...
Everybody all throughout the country was just getting really distraught. Mm-hmm. And in Hue, we knew that there was some undercurrent. Hue was I'd like for somebody who knew what was going on at that time.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah.
There was the everyday normal reality, and then there was just some massive something going on. Of course, you know, now we found out pretty quick. And the guy who was the ambassador in Hue, the counselor guy, been there long enough, he really didn't know what was going on. And a very dear friend of mine, Oliver and her fiance and another guy, from her guys.
Okay.
And I was just saying, we're just devastating the countryside.
This is the council from Da Nang.
Yeah, was I don't know that he was... I think actually now that I'm thinking about it, he's probably CIA, mm-hmm. working out of the council in Da Nang, and his fiancée, the Vietnamese woman, mm-hmm. was there, and we were here in her home, mm-hmm. with her family there, mm-hmm. and he's saying we can destroy the country and build it back better, and I'm saying you're an asshole. And the other man from Cultural Affairs in Saigon is also saying you're an asshole. You know, we weren't saying that.
Right.
We weren't point blank like that. Mm-hmm. Ended up in the electric. They killed. When they looked for Americans, so-called American civilians, if you had weapons, they killed you. The Vietnamese did.
This guy who made that comment, what happened to him during the genocide?
He ended up hiding in the behind the wall in the electric company and watching all this devastation.
In Hue.
Uh-huh. And he did, he escaped, and he got out, and his... Tweecom, his sleep ended up, everybody's home. Sandra Johnson and Marge Nelson.
Mm-hmm. And they were?
Sandra was an IBSer, mm-hmm. and Marge Nelson was American.
Police?
Yeah, after 6 weeks.
After about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And a couple of IBSers weren't so lucky.
No. Mark Kaye and Gary Davis.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up spending the rest of the war. Talk to them after the war? What were their feelings about that?
Well, I didn't really talk to Mark. Mm-hmm. I may have talked to him, but Gary was fine. Mm-hmm. He was just wonderful, and I'm really thank you.
But what you mean Gary was fine? You mean Gary? What was Gary's view of being?
I think his main concern was that he was really crushed that they couldn't distinguish him from the military.
Mm-hmm. In other words, he wasn't in Saigon, and he was out of the country. So I don't know if that reflects. Davies a little bit. And about his feeling useless, being holed up in the Hanoi Hilton for the duration of the war after Tet. What happened to you? Were you up there during? You at that time you were.
I was. I made the decision to be a good daughter.
And come back
and
to the States.
Go to my Vietnamese family in Saigon.
Go to the for Tet.
Yeah. You see. Father was in Bangkok at a conference.
Your father?
And, Vietnamese
father. Vietnamese father, right.
I felt more at home in my Vietnamese
yes.
family than
yeah.
my American family.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And Thuy was in the States, and the youngest sister was in Australia. Mm-hmm. And they were just feeling kind of bored. I really wanted to stay in Hue because I love the passion.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
and I'd never been there.
Spectacular. Yeah.
I'd never been there for Tet. I made the big sacrifice, and thereby saved my life, because I was quite ill.
Well, there were a couple of other IVSers there who I know of one, who's more than
no,
Steve. It was Chris Jenkins or David Naismith. One who was simply kept in. And it
yeah.
turned out one of the commanders in the district knew the family well,
yeah.
and actually came by and said, "Do you know who these IVS people were?" Because they wanted to know about the other ones.
Yeah.
And then he said, "Well, if you hear anything more about them, you'll let me know, won't you?" And he had a feeling that they knew he was there, but they had decided that because of this connection, they would just look the other way.
So
they were lucky in the sense, he was lucky in the sense that he was kind of discovered by the right people.
Yeah,
at the
and
right
no,
time.
I'm, the yeah. Viet, they like, they really had great capacity to discern.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that's what I was talking about there at the very end when we changed the tape. This gentleman, didn't know whether, IVS was CIA or not.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
What's interesting is that on the other side, they had they were better able to discern the difference between IVS and, let's say, USAID. Than there are times where some IVSers they waited until the IVSers left a house where a USAID officer was having dinner with them, and when they left, they rocketed the house.
Yeah.
So they knew,
I do, yeah.
seemed to have known. That seems to
record. Oh, absolutely,
mm-hmm.
absolutely.
And it's a signal. Sign of recognition,
oh,
really, in many ways.
It's amazing. Yeah. Whereas for us, we had no interest in discerning who was what.
You were you in Vietnam when Don and Gene Stolfus circulated that letter about
vividly.
Well, tell me vividly about that.
Oh, I was. I almost went with him, but I didn't at that point. It, not that I didn't feel as strongly as they did. I just wasn't ready to leave. I talked to Don a lot, and I felt a little bit that I was, when they left, I was going to be by that time I was a technical specialist, so I was in something of a leadership role. I've been there longer than anybody else, and at that time I might have said I was fluent. Now I understand what fluency is a little bit better. I don't have it.
I'm interested in knowing when they went to a formal TESOL program. When IVS started doing that, because before there was just some language training,
right?
But there wasn't any training for the teachers who were going to teach English as a second language.
No.
When did that start?
We had it.
You had it even in 63.
Mm-hmm. We had practice teaching, and we had, and Billy Lee was the ESL technical specialist at that time.
Billy Lee Langley.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Dr. Allardyce, we called her Dr. Allardyce, Dr. Allardyce for AID was very interested in making sure we got training. And she did for us to observe, and I'm saying, well, maybe she's not such a crock. If she's got that kind of guts. No, and I don't know if Billy Lee's group did, but probably not. And it's probably Billy Lee that said, you've got to teach these people how to teach English.
So you felt that you were a technical specialist. If you left, the program might suffer. If you left over a political statement.
No. I felt that it was a critical time for IVS to have for the volunteers there to have some voice of IVS that. Understanding of the history of IVS in Vietnam and the issues. And
Don talk to you about this?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
What
was his reaction to that? I mean, he'd say, well, that sounds good. Or
I felt kind of designated by him to just kind of keep an eye on things. He was still enough of a chauvinist that he wasn't too sure. Like Gloria and I went in and sat him down one 64.
Someone has commented that they thought that this was a great Don Luce's resigning and the leadership in Vietnam resigning that what IVS was there for. That was a political statement that was violating IVS's.
Absolutely.
To make that statement as being consistent with the IVS mission. That was my opinion because of unheard voices. Yeah. You know, it's clear that it's interesting.
That book, I lived everything in that book. There's very little in that book tonight.
Well, Don Luce and John Summers' book, Unheard Voices, which
published
was
published in 68 or 69.
To the U.S. government to recognize the
impact.
It was just stories of what the Vietnamese were experiencing at the hands of the war and being at American hands. There was one IVSer, by the way, who was riding his bike. He did a little village round where he went to each village, of course, was not in VC hands because he went there, you know, it was bigger than him. Yeah. And very, very painful. And,
who was that?
Why don't I not say? And then, then it'll come out later, okay? Because I'll just a mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper. No, but he's in California.
Oh.
And and not in a big city. Yeah. How did you feel when did you finally leave Vietnam and not come back? What was your last?
Oh, March the 2nd, 1968. I couldn't stand it anymore. I was going to start killing Americans. Mm-hmm. Actually, because I didn't go back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you were in Saigon. That's right.
I was
right.
in Saigon, right. but plague was untouched until the Tet Offensive. Mm-hmm. Plague was just Americans, no American soldiers.
What happened in Saigon during Tet?
Well, for me, I was with my Vietnamese family. And I started listening to the radio, you know, I really don't remember, but I...
Oh, sorry, that's okay, it's just a pause button. Go ahead, yeah, huh?
Is it...
No, it pauses if you stop talking. Then.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's okay. You just have to keep talking continuously.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You're doing fine. Yes, but you stayed in a back of the room.
And when I needed to take a shower, go to the bathroom, they had to look up through the open kitchen to make sure that nobody in taller buildings was just looking down.
Just that might see you.
Yeah.
And
then elder brother took me to one of the IBS office buildings, and they was working there, and they came and took me back up.
Glad to see you?
Oh, God.
Did they know you were inside?
Oh, yeah. They knew. Elder brother was a doctor, and so he was out. You know, he was out the first night at the hospital treating me. There was just excruciating. You see, you know, every day you get a little more information, and when people would come in, relieved to see them, and they were safe, and you know, how many rounds did your helicopter take?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was really.
Well, I think I can't remember what it was. I think it was Dennis Ross. Dennis Rothar, I think. They just forgot. He was really remote. He was raising mushrooms in a distant part of the Delta. And when he finally made it in, it was like, oh, goodness, we forgot all about you. And hadn't even warned anyone that he was missing or something.
Well, Danny Whitfield was chief of party by then.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the problem. Because he didn't. No, he was good.
Mm-hmm.
He really, his politics was far from mine, but he was very respectful, but he didn't, and he was also very attuned, but he just didn't know people.
His politics were different than yours, just for the fun of it, I mean.
Well, for example,
Danny took over when Don left, so
right.
There was a kind of need for what?
Yeah. Well, it's enlightened. Gardner, A.C. Gardner came to see what was going on. Eggs and the IBS, you know, I don't even think he came in the door. He just set his suitcases down and went straight to the ambassadors. I don't even think he asked them. And so, of course, when he picks somebody to succeed, he can get to do the job. And it's not going to be. When the guys in Hue were taken prisoner, I was very upset, and I knew that looking at the anti-war, you know, trying to make contact with them, avenues of getting some information.
What did you think of the anti-war movement when you got back to the States?
Puke.
Because?
Actually, I shouldn't say that. I was just desperately glad that it existed.
I had the same problem. Yeah.
And I would just, I was just saying, what your ideology is, I want a human, you know, human responses.
Have human contact, to have a human response. In other words, in the States, everyone was dealing with abstracts. The draft is an abstract. Things exploding, people dying, is not abstract.
Yeah.
So everyone was in the same boat. The, what do you call it, the right wing with anti-communism, you know, to them that was a blank check. And the immorality of the war was a blank check, you know, mentally for other people.
Yeah.
And the few of us who, not very many Americans knew anything about Southeast Asia, and those that were caught with that knowledge were disappointed in both.
Yeah.
So there was no space.
Yeah.
And just as there was no space for real dialogue. So that's, I try to explain to that to my students. It's not that, you know, they say, well, what could we have done, or what did we do that was wrong, and we did what we did, and there probably wasn't any other another way.
I really see that. I really, in the last few, once I, the process of making peace with this whole thing, it's been extremely long term.
Mm-hmm. A lot of IVSers are reading that, by the way. Yeah. I just bought a copy. I've read everything else. It's a unit of a class that I teach.
Oh.
Where I have them read.
Send me your bibliography.
Okay.
Oh.
But it's annotated, so you're all right.
Annotated.
It's very
right.
thick.
That's better.
Yeah. I'm redoing my whole, when I'm finished, I'm redoing my whole course. It'll be up on the web, by the way, as a thing. So it'll
right.
it'll be, but it's, I don't do it anymore because I use it as the example for the students to do all the other units.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some very good, in the last 5-6 years, a very good book synthesizing that whole debate about the media. And and like everything else about the war, when you look at it close enough, it just gets very, very complicated, and it doesn't mean anything. That is it. Nothing as dramatic as you think it's going to be, and it's interesting.
It's really, well, it's the whole thing is fascinating, and I'm starting to enjoy the Civil War. Reading about the Civil War is a kind of meditation.
Do you read John McPherson? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's from Georgia. It's the University of. So yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I was going to ask you a couple of things. I do want to talk about your Vietnamese family. So let's not lose track of that.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to talk about drinking to go to sleep.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm pretty familiar with a little thing called post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's a good way of getting started.
Yeah.
And then leaving Vietnam with all that anger. What was that like those years? What were you? What were you kind of demons were you looking at?
Oh God, it was I wondered that I didn't die. The later of picking up a drink and then the physical part of the disease kicked in. Mm-hmm. So.
Interesting, because one of the questions that I ask people is, how did you feel in '77 with the quote fall of Saigon? And for you, it was a sense of relief.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh God, yes. Oh, I just peace. You know, but it was not good.
Mm-hmm.
But the bombs weren't falling anymore.
Someone said, but it didn't end. You know, then there was Cambodia and all those millions of people. And I said, that wasn't the Vietnam War. And it's interesting, actually, to justify the war, which they're entitled to do so. Look at the Khmer Rouge taking power in Cambodia as actually being a evidence of how bad the Vietnamese communists were, not realizing how much those two groups hated each other and that they fought a war against each other. But they still may be right. I'm not going on record and solving that particular one. But it is interesting. I mean, everyone has a different point of view. Yours is, thank God it's over, you know, and the other one is, well, yeah, but then look what happened. And were you aware that, with what are they called, the anti-entrepreneurial policies of the government, the new government, and it started this boat people migration.
Sure.
How did you feel about that? Did you meet people or work, do any refugee resettlement work?
I couldn't handle it. So no, I didn't. The first I did, as Saigon was falling, I was, at that point, was not, I had my MA test when I had gotten kicked out of my
class.
God only knows.
I can find out. I'm an alumni myself.
Are you really?
BA, MA, and PhD.
Really?
UCL thing? History.
No kidding. Did you know Helen Rose now?
No.
Okay.
We're going to track that back anyway. So
yeah.
let's go back a second.
Oh, I know. Right. I did want to finish this.
Good. And I do want you
I
to,
was
actually.
I was teaching at ESL at USC, and I had contacts in the ESL community throughout Southern California. Billy Lee and me.
June Polcini,
Billy Lee
Langley.
And we put together a one-day conference on teaching English to Vietnamese refugees. As Saigon was falling, and we did it in just marvelous IVS fashion. We got Vietnamese, the guy that had been the education minister to be a keynote speaker, and we had all just very practical hands-on things, and we had 300 ESL and TESOL, TESOL, California TESOL Association sponsored it, USC sponsored it, I think even UCLA sponsored it.
Mm-hmm.
I was, actually, that's where I did that grant.
Master's at UCLA,
yeah.
Tessa.
And oh, that was my one big event, my one big thing. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
We really, and it was very cathartic because we had people talking about how to help these people come, you know,
mm-hmm.
how to help these refugees. That was the end of my drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I stayed in UCLA. I went to Liberty University after that.
Say you just put your nose to the grindstone and just taught TESOL. Where were you teaching it? At USC?
At USC. There, it was wonderful, really wonderful experience.
Why did you leave to go to Woodbury?
At that point, my job was not recognized as a tenured position.
Mm-hmm.
USC at that point was one of the finest ESL programs in the country. I was getting sober then, too,
mm-hmm.
and I was not capable of working for about 6 months. No, contacts.
Mm-hmm.
I never...
So someone you knew in Woodbury said, hey, you know,
I knew so
position.
Many people by that time.
Right.
The whole time I was in LA, I never really had to look for a job. They came to me.
Let's go back. Kind of like the ideal IVS experience is when someone says, my Vietnamese father, my Vietnamese mother, or something
oh,
like
yeah.
that. I mean, that is a wonderful thing.
Yes, it
and,
is.
And unfortunately, I spent so much time interviewing, like, educationists who very often didn't build that bond because they were in a group, in a school, and they didn't have that opportunity really at all. And I wondered how that came about. How did you evolve into that relationship, beginning with where and when?
Actually, I had more than one
mm-hmm.
family. I had my first family was in Meetah,
mm-hmm.
and it was one of our high school girls. And I just, Thanh and Quy were our first Vietnamese friends, and Thanh is the one that...
Could you spell that?
T-H-A-N-H.
Uh-huh.
And she's the one that lived with us. We just hit it off, and I would go over to visit her family. I knew from day one that I wanted to get as far away from American society as I could, that I did not come to Vietnam to spend my time with Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Anxious about that. As time went on, I get, boy, if you're American, I'm not interested.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to visit her on Saturdays. And my first Tet in Vietnam, I went to her house for that late evening dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just didn't spend the kind of time that I do with my family in Saigon, but there. Actually, the daughter, Thuy, was she was an ESL teacher. I wanted to be there, and I was. And
mm-hmm.
Poor Thuy, she was too gracious. She enjoyed it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was mutual, but mm-hmm. she didn't. She's very traditional,
mm-hmm.
and given her preferences, she didn't. She just wanted to go be with her family. She
mm-hmm.
didn't want anybody else around. But mm-hmm. I would show up at her doorstep in Saigon. And then I ended up staying there. And they just, they liked me and I liked them. And there was no, later I would, because they wouldn't, there was no way I could pay them for staying. Very early, we'd sit on a Saturday afternoon. If I come in on a Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon, we'd sit there in the late afternoon and drink beer and eat cashew nuts and smoke. And,
mm-hmm.
and then the sisters her daughters would translate for us.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd tell me stories about Hanoi and just, you know.
These were Catholic immigrants?
No, they were Buddhists.
They were
Buddhists?
Why were they in the South?
Because father had worked for the Viet Minh, and
mm-hmm.
He actually was the highest non-political person in the Minister of Compassion.
But he had come South with the Viet Minh while fighting the French?
No.
Ah,
he, in the 40s,
mm-hmm.
early 40s, he mm-hmm. was outside of Hanoi
mm-hmm.
with the Viet Minh,
mm-hmm.
and he just... assassinations of peasants, but couldn't have been that early. But he didn't like them. Mm-hmm. And he left. And so at partition time, it was not going to be safe for him to stay in Hanoi. So they came south.
But, yeah, there it goes. I just wondered what we were watching as the dog sniffed the tape there and make sure that things are running well. He eventually evolved into essentially a high civil servant,
right.
A non-political appointee, yeah. In the ministry. And what was their fate? How did that work out?
They came to the States, mm-hmm. And I think, and I did service. Classic North Vietnamese. Really shocked when I went to Hanoi
in 87,
and mm-hmm. I saw the first older woman with black teeth and a child. Oh, mommy! And she was pivotal. She was central. She was really important to me.
Uh-huh.
We, in the like.
You want to get
that? May be your. Let's
listen. Oh, that's right. Okay, so we'll just. We're back on the tape again. Did you have that kind of relationship with anyone in Hue?
I had a family that I this Thuy Cong, the woman who ultimately married the CIA
right.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
Her family was really really neat, and there it was, a mom and daughter. Again, mothers and daughters,
mm-hmm.
And in Hue weather, it is gorgeous, and I love it, but it's cold and wet and rainy it starts raining in November, and it doesn't quit until March or April.
Mm-hmm.
You have a whole culture around trying to keep warm, and what you do is you big Vietnamese bed with the quilts on it, and you sit on the bed and visit, well, when all the chores are done, and old lady out in the rain with the hot soup vendor goes up and down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And so you chatter, 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 and eat hot soup. And with Thuy Cong's family. It wasn't as close to them, like Thuy's family.
Mm-hmm.
They really were family. Mm-hmm. And they, when I got really good food when I came home, and
mm-hmm.
I could keep down what she fixed. And
why were you so ill?
A tropical sprue.
A sprue?
Sprue, intestinal lining, just can't take it.
And
it leaves.
I see.
And you're left with, you can't digest your food.
Uh-huh.
Clean in case you have any infections.
Hmm.
And you just turn around.
Are you a member of the IVS Alumni Association?
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever contributed
yeah.
money to
oh,
IVS?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I, especially when Rick Pyatt died, I was close to him.
Mm-hmm.
But regularly.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what's going on in IVS these days?
Fairly.
Mm-hmm.
Not
a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
They have to know.
Yeah, that one I know about. If Don has to be with him, I'm more.
The dog would have dinner, so.
Yes.
Late afternoon.
What's your dog?
Well, I had a golden retriever.
Oh.
Let's see. One last thing. Let's see. What else was I going to ask you? What did you think of the relationship between how USAID and IVS worked?
I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
And I think because they really understood that we were there to, or at least from my contact,
right.
That we were there to. This government thought we should be located where the Vietnamese government thought we should be. That's the word. I think of the agony that you're in, the just the irreconcilable paradoxes that you have to solve. One is that we did so much for education and for the doing the universities and the normal schools. And the teacher training, and the science education, and the agriculture stuff, just all these wonderful. And doing it, from my point of view, from what I saw, we weren't telling anybody what to do. we were trying to, as best we could at that in that era, mm-hmm. to stand beside people and face in the same direction they were and say, okay, now what can we do together? Or here, this, how would you like to try this? And then instead of, you know, saying this is the way we're going to do it, just really trying to be centered in people's needs and felt needs. And there was just about that whole country. Americans were doing that. Mm-hmm. And then the friggin' military overwhelms it with the violence.
Mm-hmm. We're working, the USAID people you're talking about were those involved directly in education.
Education and Arlington. Mm-hmm. It was AID agriculture. From, about ex-IVSers in
mm-hmm. Yes, a lot.
Some of the refugees, some of the people working with refugees.
Well, where are the, I mean, did you ever think about what happened after 66 when CORDS was created? Did that have any impact?
I didn't. At that time I was in Hue and
right.
I really didn't lost a lot of contact with that. I had more contact with what was going on in agriculture. Mm-hmm. When I was in
traces to the, there's an additional thrust given to pacification efforts after 66 for a while, but it was, the thrust was to get the military and USAID to work together, but the problem is it also kind of militarized the pacification program. Yeah, and we're just interested in what the outcome of that was, and it's interesting because some IVSers work with extremely devout AID people, I mean, who were really doing very good work, and others were dealing with ex-cops from the United States who were, you know.
Or ex-military. Boy, we had one in Meacham who was ex-military. Spit, shine, shoes, just wait. And now, I didn't know John Paul Vann was in Meacham. Mm-hmm. I had no idea.
Well, he also went to Vung Thao.
Yeah.
And he used to have dinner with Don Cohan. And Don, you know, says, boy, you know, he really, you know, he would always ask me about IVS and, you know, what we were doing. He, of course, he doesn't remember the conversations he had. But Vann was obviously, you know, that was the kind of, the way he felt the war could be won. And these were the kinds of people who were doing it. And he was, you know, kicking around in his head a bit, which... you've now read Bright and Shining Lie. What was inside that head now will be distorted forever by his other things that supposedly he was interested in. And Neil Sheehan, I know Neil Sheehan, and I would not want him to write my biography. And I think, by the way, there's serious factual flaws in that book. Very
is that
serious
right?
ones.
Is
yeah.
that like what?
All the very important things are probably not true.
Oh, really?
And I don't know what to do about it at this remove. There seems to be a logical inconsistency. If Vann thought he couldn't be promoted to colonel because of his sexual escapades,
that would be known.
What is that? He somehow seems to make that have something to do with the fact that Vann, therefore, didn't decided to just blow off his program. He had this revolutionary program for remodeling the Saigon regime, actually. But he did go forward with it. That is, he got to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he got a brief...